And now what we've seen since 2007 is the developed markets come up, the emerging markets come up more in terms of debt. There's a great chart that I'm looking at in the McKinsey study, and it shows the debt to GDP ratio. Now, this is for all sectors. This is government, corporate, household, and the financial sector. Of course, number one is Japan, and it ranges down, and we have still above the 100% line, essentially 39 countries, which is extraordinary, that have a debt to GDP ratio. So let me just give you some numbers. Japan, Ireland, Singapore, Portugal, Belgium, Netherlands, Greece, Spain, Denmark, and Sweden are the top 10. United States is 16 with 233. Of course, that doesn't include all of all the stuff, you know, off balance sheet, you know, not reported. I'll never forget. I just have to tell this story. Secretary Paul O'Neill announcing that he'd hired a bunch of guys and they'd come up with a study that collected up all the liabilities of the United States. And I said, I don't think that's a very good idea. He put it up on the website. 2 days later, it's down and he is leaving the administration. So if he'd gotten away with that, I suspect the number would be more than 223. Anyway, but now, interestingly enough, if you look at who's, you know, who has a very low to debt ratio, one of the lowest, of course, is our friends in Russia, who, as a result of what happened in the 90s, have never again levered up. So they, in one sense, they come into this situation very, very strong. And then the ones who succeeded in achieving a very low one, particularly, you know, unlevering or delevering during this period is Israel.
Yep.
So they're very low. So so we've seen this this continuing explosion. The one thing I wanted to point out, within the numbers, there are some countries that are financial centers. So Singapore, the Netherlands, and because they're financial centers, they have a tendency to balloon their balance sheets. But if you look at their balance sheets and the real assets they have behind it, I think their situation is much stronger than it might indicate. So, for example, one of my favorites is Norway at number 14. They've got a 244 debt to GDP ratio. If you look at what they've got in their sovereign wealth funds, you know, they are the most, to me, the most financially sound country in the world, they and Switzerland. So, so the numbers aren't perfect. You've got to look at the unique situations. But needless to say, it's tremendous. One of the things I hadn't realized until I read this was from the 2007 on, one of the ways that we kept global growth going was China levered up tremendously during this period.
Yes.
And China now has, let me see if I can find the number. China now has 217. That was at the second quarter 2014. I'm sure it's still growing. And they estimate that China's contribution during this period increased 35, you know, made up 35% of global growth. So we've basically kept the global growth going by continuing the leveraging, dramatically increasing it in the emerging markets, particularly on China.
Yep.
And that is not a pretty picture now that we have a global slowdown.
That's right. That's right. That's right. It's going to have to get into an inevitable geopolitical consequence of all of this. And one thing, since you mentioned China and using it as more or less the leverage locomotive that we see going on, that was spelled out in that McKinsey report. The other thing I think we have to take note of is a development very, very recently, I think within the last couple of weeks since you mentioned Russia. And that was the recent decision by the Russian Federation to allow China to hold 50% or more of the ownership in the developing Siberian energy fields. Now that's a huge, huge development because what this means.
That is a huge development.
Oh, it's you know, I was really kind of dumb, struck dumb with that because, you know, if we can turn the clock back, say, to the Brezhnev era and with the tensions between the Soviet Union and China, that would never have been even remotely, it just would not have even been mentioned. And now what this means is it's going to give China a huge amount of influence, not only in Russian Siberia, but there are similar deals being worked out now, from what I understand, with China and Central Asia as part of the Eurasian Economic Union. So we're going to see China attempt, I think, to use the current geopolitically weak position of Russia to drastically expand their influence. And I think this is really kind of their response to them being used basically as the leverage locomotive, as the Kinzer report clearly spelled out. I think this is partly their response. So we're going to see huge geopolitical consequences to everything you're saying. And this is the other thing that people are going to have to look out and look out dramatically. China, I don't know if your listeners are aware of this, but China has begun an advertising campaign, putting up billboards in Canada, even in this country, announcing the renminbi, you know, the Chinese currency. It's time for the renminbi. They're actually advertising this. They're launching this advertising campaign. So this is a huge development, and it's all going to have some dramatic geopolitical consequences. And I think you're going to see, inevitably, you're going to see this spill over into Forex and everything else. So it's, you know, it's hard to keep up with all of this. It really is.
Well, I sat down and collected up a list of all the Chinese lending and equity investment projects that I could find. And what's interesting about what the Chinese are up to is they are, you know, just as we used to run around the world with the Ex-Im Bank and try and build deals for American firms, they are literally, you know, they've become the lender of last resort around the world. Right. And they're doing a huge lending business, but they're very focused on what will build economic growth, what will build opportunities for Chinese companies, things like high-speed trains, you know, things they've really developed, but also what will lock them up the natural resources. And if you look at the way they're doing it, it's very smart. But they are absolutely focused on building, you know, they may be lenders, but they're acting like equity investors. They're acting like principals. Whereas, you know, if you look at what the U.S. is doing, we're playing, you know, we're paying the we bring chaos and we destroy infrastructure game. And the Chinese are saying, we want to build you a high-speed rail. And so America has woken up, and now we're the bad guys.
And since you mentioned that they're acting like equity investors and mentioned high-speed rail, I think it was just within the last week or so, there has been another announcement, I think it was covered on RT, that Russia and China are talking about building a 7,000-kilometer-long high-speed train, rail service, going across China through Central Asia or the Altai and then on up to Moscow. So in other words, they're building a high-speed rail basically through Kazakhstan is what they're talking
right.
about. And
right.
again, the geopolitical implications of that are enormous. This will be
right.
another Trans-Siberian railroad, only much further south. It will project China.
And much faster.
And much
right.
faster, yeah. This will project Chinese power and influence into the region, and it will be an actual infrastructure that's being built by the Chinese and the Russians. So in other words, this is a geopolitical development that is going to cement the two biggest BRICS nations together even more tightly, and it's going to have its own consequence for the development of the renminbi as what they want is a reserve currency status. And I think the other part of this game, Catherine, is the Chinese have been pushing for many, many years for a much bigger voice in the IMF, World Bank, and so on and so forth. So this is another card that they're playing to get that influence. So all of this is going to be huge.
Right. One of the big questions this year, I'm skipping ahead, is, you know, the U.S. for several years now has refused to approve the changes that the IMF wants so that they can start to do a variety of things, including bring the Chinese more, but engage in debt restructurings or debt jubilees.
Right.
And the you know, the Congress won't, the administration has supported it, the Congress won't go for it and is trying to hold it up. And I think at this point, what's going to be interesting this year is if the IMF, you know, comes up with plan B and tries to work around or walk away from the Americans.
Oh, yeah. I can easily see that happening. I can easily see that happening. Go ahead.
You go.
Well, part of the problem, as I see it, Catherine, is what we're seeing now, too, geopolitically, is a huge amount of blowback from Europe, principally from Germany, but to a certain extent from France as well, a huge amount of blowback toward American policy vis-a-vis the Ukraine, vis-a-vis Russia, and so on. Germany, in particular, I was just dumbfounded when the German defense minister or foreign minister, I forget who it was, just this last week, called for
the... It was the ECB president, Juncker. It was the ECB.
Yeah, it was Juncker. That's right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Juncker, calling for the creation of a European-wide NATO independent, in other words, a non-NATO European army. And, you know, from where I sit, this is simply Germany trying to dodge the treaty restrictions that were imposed on that nation after the reunification. What they're really trying to do is, in the guise of creating a European-wide army, drastically expand the actual German military. And this comes just a few weeks after we had that very strange speech of Frank-Walter Steinmeier, the German foreign minister, in that hotel in Berlin, calling for a much more militaristic German foreign policy on the world stage. When you have to ask yourself, well, why are they doing this? Well, it's because I'm quite convinced that the Germans are, again, thinking that we are no longer reliable allies. We've gotten ourselves into this mess with the Ukraine and with Russia. So they're looking at all of this and trying to figure out how can we extricate ourselves and the rest of Europe from NATO. So in other words, you've got the Chinese, you've got the Russians building this railroad, you've got this push in Europe, and I strongly think that the IMF that you mentioned, trying to renegotiate the rules, I think a lot of this pressure is coming from Europe, and it's probably coming mostly from Germany. Has to.
Right. I was sitting, the last time I was in China, I was sitting in Beijing, and it was the day of Deng's funeral. And I was with an employee of mine who's a PRC citizen, and the Clinton administration was in the middle of a huge war with the Chinese over human rights.
Mm-hmm.
And we were reading the local or the Beijing paper, and it was describing in Chinese the war. And the employee looked at me and he said, "Do you understand what this fight is really about?" And I said, "No." And he said, "The vast majority of our legislators are engineers or economists.
Yep.
The vast amount of your legislators are lawyers.
Yep.
And you are saying to us, do this, and we are saying, how?" How? You know, so it was, he said, this isn't a fight between America and China. This is a fight a bunch of lawyers making headlines and a bunch of engineers trying to get something done.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. And the Germans are engineers.
Yes, exactly.
That's what they are. So right.
It's the same problem, you know, and we need to remind ourselves of the geopolitical consequences of a nation's economy, particularly in the case of Germany, and I've mentioned this before. Germany, you know, it's the size of the state of Texas, and yet,
right,
if you look at the size of their economy, it's enormous.
Well, believe it or not, I put up your article about the speech of the Germans to the businessmen.
Right.
I put that article up on the blog. with two graphics. One was a picture of the DAX, the German Bourse, which has outperformed the S&P on a 1, 2, 5, and 10-year time horizon. That's number one. And number two was the video for Leonard Cohen's song, First We Take Manhattan, Then We Take Berlin.
That's good. Well, yeah, you know, you look at Germany, it's a relatively small nation geographically. It has no strategic depth, and it's sitting on top of this enormous manufacturing base with no natural resources. So, in other words, we're right back where we were with Kaiser Wilhelm.
Well, but this is why the Brits wanted a war with Germany, was there was no way the 20th century would be the Anglo-American century if they didn't first pummel the Germans into the ground. Okay, so let me get back to the debt question, because if you look at the debt of Japan, our number one debt problem in the world is Japan.
Yes.
Who, and I would submit to you, when the war ended, we left two armies of occupation, one in Germany and one in Japan.
Yes.
And if you study what has happened with Japanese debt, it looks like the Americans have been running a huge, you know, basically dollar, you know, carry trade through Japan, and have been squeezing Japan unmercilessly for, you know, essentially free cost of capital during the 90s while we were bubbling the economy. You had all these hedge funds who could borrow from the Japanese for 0%.
Yes.
You know, what was that about? So it looks to me like we've squeezed the Japanese, you know, incredibly in this process, and that's why they have debt as high as they do. Now, we've had an army in Germany. How did Germany avoid the Japanese trap?
Oh, boy. The two questions, I think, are very directly connected, and I'm going to try and be as general as I can, because I'm currently writing a book that goes into some details that not many people know about in terms of Germany, in terms of my thesis that there has always been, since the end of the war, some sort of international extraterritorial fascist organization, Nazi organization, whatever you wish to call it. But you're absolutely right that Japan appears to have been more or less victimized because of the American military presence there. And the difference between Japan and Germany was that Japan set a limit on how much of their budget, basically, could be spent on their military. And that limit has always been very, very small. It's only under the current Japanese government of Mr. Abe that you have now very open talk in Japan of rearming. And the ostensible talk, Catherine, is that they're rearming at the behest of the Americans to take a greater share in Pacific security and to take a greater share of defense burdens off the United States against China. But I strongly, strongly suspect that what the Japanese are really doing is playing like they're going along, but rearming because they too have had enough of the American hegemony game. I strongly suspect that this is their long-term goal. And until they get that kind of military strength up and running again, they're not going to be able to challenge much of the financial diktat coming out of Washington.
Right.
Now, the Germans, on the other hand, have had, since the end of the war and the grant of sovereignty to West Germany, the Germans have had, on a percentage basis, a larger military all along than Japan. And this has meant, by way of implication of that, it has meant that the German armaments industry has remained one of their largest armaments industries to this day. In fact, most Americans don't even know this, but to tell you just how huge the German armaments industry is, the gun on the American A1 Abrams tank is a German gun. that's produced under license. The gun is actually a German gun made by the firm of Rheinmetall, all right? So in other words, the German armaments industry is more than capable of re-equipping and has been re-equipping the German military since the end of the war. So they've kept that heavy tool and die industry in Germany in a way that Japan did not. So Germany, I think, is able to avoid some of this pressure for that reason alone. The second thing that I think we have to look at in Germany's case, and I throw this out here, Catherine, as one of my typical high-octane speculations, because I do think, and I made the joke during the Secret Space Program conference in my first talk about how I suspect that the Bilderberger Group was originally set up in large part to manage all the transfer of all that Axis loot into the Western banking system and then have some of it transferred back in the form of American aid to Europe, you know, Marshall Plan and so on and so forth. And I strongly suspect that that was one reason that the Bilderberg Group was set up. But as I pointed out, to do that, to achieve that, you had to have at some point the cooperation of the surviving Axis elite in Europe.
Yes.
Because they're the ones that know ultimately where all of that money is stashed.
Right.
And what this means is, quite bluntly, that, you know, Mr. Rockefeller and Mr. Rothschild made a deal with the devil. And I pointed out in the form of a joke, when you're dealing with Martin Bormann, and, you know, I believe that he survived the bunker and was in charge of this post-war Nazi organization, very clearly so. When you're making a deal with Martin Bormann, you're dealing with Dick Cheney without the warmth and charm. And at some point, that marker is going to come due. And they have the infrastructure, the international organization, like you say, to kill with impunity. So
right.
There's a bit of a mafia war going on here. I suspect very strongly, Catherine, that Germany's strength is due in some measure to the continuing hidden influence of that Axis loot. And I strongly suspect it's also due to the continuing hidden influence of that international fascist organization. If you think
right, and their military capacity.
And their military, yes, precisely. Germany has
right.
a small military, but people have to understand that Germany has had that kind of military ever since the Kaiser. What people don't realize is that in the German system of reserves, that military can be turned into an enormous military virtually in a month if they have to. So in other words, Germany, and again, you know, it's not because the Germans are particularly militaristic, it's just because of their geopolitical situation, their enormous manufacturing economy, their lack of natural resources. This is always going to be a reality of German geopolitics.
Right.
So I strongly suspect that you have some sort of influence going on behind the scenes. And I know that sounds just nuts, but if you doubt the existence of a...
Oh, no, I'm highly con... When I put up that video, first we take Manhattan, then we take Berlin, I was very serious.
Well, yeah, you know, but what I'm saying is if there's people out there that doubt that there is a continuing fascist organization, what I would suggest they do is look very carefully at the government that this country helped put into place in Kiev during the coup. Because
right.
you have elements in that government that are very clearly connected to wartime fascist organizations in the Ukraine, Stefan Bandera and so on and so forth. You look at some of the insignia that some of the Ukrainian militia touts and openly displays, and it's very clearly inspired from wartime German military. So this, I think, is one of the factors that's lying hidden and lurking behind the scenes. We wouldn't have the German foreign minister, we wouldn't have the statements of Juncker recently calling for these types of things, I don't think, unless they felt secure enough to do so. So I think you're looking at some hidden influence there from that leftover fascist outfit. I think it still exists. I think there's some hidden money in play that has kept them afloat. So yeah, I'm hoping in the next few months to get something done by way of detailed analysis on that of that sort.
Okay, so very quickly, one of the things I wanted to mention was that the debt in Japan was very high before. They never wrote it down in 89, so they've kept it going. It got higher and higher, but it's really exploded since Fukushima.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's not an accident. There is a relationship between what Fukushima did to their economy and what they've done to respond with the debt, as well as the real reasons Fukushima might have happened.
Oh yes, I totally agree. When Fukushima happened, this occurred after the Japanese elections. I think it was 2008, 2009. They swept out the Liberal Democrats that had been more or less the main ruling party in Japan since the end of the war, and a new government came in. The new government then promptly turned around and politely requested that the Americans shut their base in Okinawa. There was talk with Beijing of having Emperor Akihito go to Beijing on a state visit, you know, bury the hatchet. And, you know, this was an enormous geopolitical earthquake, these two things. And then the then U.S. Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, made that, it can be construed as nothing less than a threat, that if Japan continued on this course, there would be dire consequences. And then about a month later, of course, we had Fukushima.
Right.
So the way I'm looking at it, again, you know, the current Japanese government of Mr. Abe, I think, is playing along with American requests for a hike in Japanese defense spending and basically rearming that country. But I think the long-term agenda there in Japan's case is they're playing along, but the real goal is to beef up Japanese military power so that they don't have to kowtow to every diktat that's coming out of Washington. There's no doubt in my mind. None.
Right. Okay, so let's turn to, I call this section, What the Bleep is Really Going On Here? Because the one thing, whenever you look at the statistics, you know, we see debt.
When I read that, I laughed out loud. I sat here in my office and I just laughed.
Well, this is not a financial system. When people loan to other people more than those other people can ever pay back,
right.
You know, something else is going on. Now, let me just say, there are very different kinds of debt. If I can print currency, so if I can make a Catherine currency on my computer and just print it off, mm-hmm. and I issue lots of bonds payable in Catherine currency, you know, I'm in great shape because I can just print more currency off my computer.
Sure.
So when people say that the U.S. is loaded up with debt, it's like, well, fine, they can just print, you know. They can just print money to pay it all off.
Yes, to, exactly.
You know, so if you're borrowing in a currency that you can print, that's very different than if you're borrowing in a currency you can't print. So when I look around at who you know, what debt is it and who owns it, you know, if I'm just printing it in dollars and my central bank is buying it and it's just a merry-go-round, I'm not sure, you know, that puts us – That may put my citizens under a lot of control and debasement, but they're really ultimately within the total system. There isn't the kind of debt we associate with bankruptcy in the classical sense.
Right.
But if you look at this explosion of unsustainable debt more and more and more, the question is, who owns this debt?
Right. And
we don't know. Trying to get good statistics, it's really easy to get good statistics on who owes the debt, but when you try and dig in and get good statistics on who owns it, it's a very, you know, it's and it's remarkably.
Yeah. It's the other question is what's collateralizing it?
Exactly.
You know, this is where I think, again, we have to go back and as you say, they're printing money to pay off the debt. Well, okay, but what's the collateral, you know? And I think
right.
We have to go back, pardon me, to what we said earlier. If you're analyzing all of this on a conventional model where you're only looking at the overt system, then you're going to miss what is potentially right in front of your nose. And that is the idea that I advanced in that first talk in the space program conference, is that they secretly collateralized space and whatever's out there. And we know for a fact right now that there is a tremendous amount of wealth in the form of resources, minerals, and so on, not only on the moon, but in the asteroid belt and so on. And this is why you see all of this talk about mining asteroids, mining the moon, and so on and so forth. That's the collateral on the debt. And when you look at the vast amount of resources out there, lo and behold, you find a very interesting thing. You find that the numbers of the available resources out there, interestingly enough, are in, guess what, quadrillions of dollars. And
right.
what other figure do we know from recent financial history is running into the quadrillions of dollars? Well, it's all of those derivatives. So I strongly suspect that there is some sort of connection between these two things. And the connection, I think, was again, this hidden system of finance, secretly collateralized space. Now they're pushing all of this talk about going out to the asteroid belt and mining asteroids and mining the moon. Well, this is the consequence of all of those derivatives. This is the consequence of that hidden system of finance. They're telling us, in other words, we're going out there precisely in order to balance the books, as it were.
There's when I did in the 90s, when I built place-based relational databases
Excuse
of
me.
The financial assets and flows in the United States. Mm-hmm. That would allow me to look at it by sector and by place. You know, I could, with relational databases, you can cross-cut it in a variety of ways. And one of the things I discovered, I was able to simulate what would happen if we took government spending, contracts, regulation, and put it, basically re-engineered it to a standard of optimizing return on investment to taxpayers.
Right.
And so instead of allocating it according to political criteria, just said, oh, you know, what the heck, let's just optimize what would happen. And what you got was an enormous explosion in equity valuations of real estate, of companies, you know, it was just, and you took $1 trillion of small business income and you multiplied it by 5 to 10 times because yep. you could securitize it. So it was quite dramatic. And I realized, oh, wait a minute, there's no reason for poverty whatsoever. We're very wealthy. There's plenty of money. Now, that was one source of value. The other, which of course you know, is you have gotten a picture of some of the technology that's sitting within the black budget that could, in theory, be re-engineered out into the general economy. We see some coming out now in terms of fabrication technology, but there's material sciences, there's Yeah. breakthrough energy, on and on and on. If that was free to move into the economy, the productivity explosion would be absolutely amazing.
It would be off the charts. And you raise an interesting possibility here that perhaps what's really going on is they're waiting for the moment or the time when they can make some sort of announcement or get enough critical mass built into the privatization of space, which we're seeing proceed apace at a phenomenal rate. I'm dumbfounded at some of the things I've been reading. Once you get that critical mass assembled and people enthused about the privatization of space and space assets and so on, then you roll out the exotic technologies.
Well, I was wondering if they just wanted everybody so up to their suspenders in debt that when they rolled it out, they had control.
Yep.
And when they marked up the equity, you know, your debt, you know, left you beholden to them.
Yep.
So exactly. you want to turn everybody into an indentured servitude before you give them technology that can make them all powerful.
Exactly. Exactly. I think that's definitely part of the game. Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Well, let's assume that the central banks own some of the debt, the governments own some of the debt. We've had a report last year showing, in fact, between sovereign wealth funds and government pension funds and other government pools, currency reserves. Mm. You know, the amount of financial asset and equities owned by governmental entities and sovereign entities is extraordinary. I mean, they're clearly the major player in the markets. But it's not everything. So, you know, as far as I know, it could be the breakaway civilization's endowment fund.
Oh, yeah.
So we could have, yeah. You know, they stole enough to finance everybody.
Yeah. And, you know, since we're talking about equity, you know, you start looking at exotic technologies and so on. As far as I'm concerned, and I'm no financial advisor or analyst or anything, but, you know, if I had that kind of money to invest in stocks or something like, of that nature, I'd be looking very carefully at some of these technology companies.
Right.
Elon Musk, the Tesla thing. I'd look very, very carefully at companies like that, because they're going to be the ones that, like you say, they're going to be the ones that are going to have their control. So if you want a measure of freedom and independence, you have to have some equity in those types of companies.
Right. Well, it's been biotech and technology that have been it's been healthcare, biotech, and technology that have been the real leaders and continue strong even in down periods. So it's, you know, this the whole analysis we did last year on 3.0 is holding true.
Yeah,
it's exactly. You know, it is where it's going.
Yeah.
Well, let's look at another aspect, because one of my big concerns about this year when I put together the scenario designs for the wrap-up was the possibility of a bear trap in the U.S. dollar.
Right.
So let's go back to these numbers in the chart in the McKinsey study on page 4. What we're seeing is the financial institutions really sort of engineered the coup, but through the bailouts, they've delevered. So they're in, you know, sort of think of them as the vacuum cleaners. They've managed to transfer the debt onto the government balance sheets and, in some respects, the corporations and households. The households, the corporations have had really a field day because they've been borrowing very cheap, stock market's high. So they're in great shape. The banks are now in fairly good shape, and of course households and governments have just been loaded up.
Right.
And of course now the siren song begins, oh, the way to solve this problem is government should sell more of its assets for cheap to the corporations who are now rich with cash and the financial institutions who are rich with cash and in a strong position. You know, so there's a new round to the financial coup. But the other thing that's happening is we now have many of the people and sovereign nations throughout the world who, as QE was happening from 2010 until last year, when did it start, 2012 or 2000, whenever it started. So we had QE1, QE2, QE3. QE's now over, and dollars are no longer cheap.
That's right.
But we've seen trillions of dollars of borrowing in the dollar carry trade all around the world. And now, with the global slowdown, dollars are getting harder and harder to earn. The dollar rose 12.5% last year. It's risen another 2% since the beginning of the year. And so it's harder to earn dollars. Dollars are more expensive to borrow. If the Fed raises interest rates, you are going to see a bear trap globally. And no matter, you know, no matter that the Chinese and Russia and all these guys have been running around doing what makes good long-term sense, the U.S. can literally put the entire emerging world over a barrel.
Yeah.
And like, and jerk their leash with higher interest rates.
Yep. Yep.
Now, interestingly enough, if you look at the U.S. situation, you have an entire insurance industry and pension fund industry that's made lots of promises based on yield assumptions that can't be met if yields continue to stay as low as they are. So if you're the Fed, you can bolster your own, you know, sort of financial situation by raising interest rates. You know, you start to give some return to savers. If you look at in 1990, you know, on a $100,000 CD deposit, we've dropped from $6,000 to $9,000 a year return to $300. So savers have gotten slaughtered by this. This is part of what's happened to the middle class. They're not getting any return on their savings at the same time that their incomes are dropping. So if you're the Fed, you can bolster a lot of people and a lot of things by raising interest rates, but you clobber the emerging markets and pull them in on your leash.
Yeah.
And the question is, could that happen?
I think so. Yes, I really do. For one thing, there are geopolitical pressures to do so, because basically what you're saying is the dollar bear trap really cements and solidifies the reserve currency status of the dollar. And there are geopolitical pressures. We've just talked about some of them, Russia and China, the railway, the Chinese buying, now being able to buy over 50% stake in those Russian energy fields in Siberia. So there's geopolitical pressures to do so. So I think, I think it's more than possible. Absolutely.
Well, it's going to be a very ugly picture.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it's an ugly picture. The dollar spiked up this morning. It's pretty, you know, it's up another 2% year to date. And
wow.
And it's a, you know, you just saw a lot of things fall out of bed. Now they recovered, but it's going to be it's going to be a real bloodbath. Now, what that means, Joseph, is the people who have stockpiled the winnings of the financial coup can buy a lot of stuff cheap. If you go back to 97, when we saw the trouble in Russia, what happened? We had the East Asia crisis, and that's how the U.S. got in and got big positions in Korea and other countries in the equity for cheap.
Yep.
So we've seen Exxon going in and...
Yeah, it would be a huge version of the East Asia crisis. Huge.
Right.
It would be truly global.
Well, we've seen Exxon go in and get fabulous new positions and leases in Russian oil.
In Russia, yep, exactly.
Yep.
Exactly.
So that's exactly what they're doing.
Yep, absolutely.
So let me ask you something. If you were running the U.S., is that what you would do?
If I was running the U.S.?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd do two things. I'd say, okay, you know, we have this bear trap possibility. So we need to sit down and talk about the Ukraine. We need to sit down and really reconsider how much of this NATO that we really want to continue, because it's been more of a problem. But I don't know that I would do it simply as a matter of asserting American power. I'd hold it in reserve as kind of a hole card in a poker game.
So it's the worst case.
It's the worst case, exactly. Exactly.
One of the other study McKinsey did recently was on the impact of low interest rates, and one of the things they estimated was that essentially sovereign governments had gotten about a $1.5 trillion windfall from the low interest rates.
Right.
So they're, you know, and we've seen in Europe, we have Japan, in Asia, and then Germany and several European countries going to negative interest rates. In fact, a week ago, you had to go out to 20 years to get a positive interest rate in the Swiss yield curve.
Yep.
So, and we had the Danish central governor, you know, central bank governor say, you know, don't test us on this, because we can go to deeply negative interest rates and stay there, which is quite remarkable. So, if you raise interest rates, then you're looking at the sovereign governments around the world losing a $1.5 trillion windfall.
Yep.
And having to pay real money to borrow. If that should happen, it's going to be, advantage to corporations. And I go back to I believe there's a long-term effort to re-engineer assets out of governments and into corporations. And certainly corporations will have a field day, because they're the ones who are going to have the capital.
Yep. Absolutely. And it's going to solidify, again, that's another pressure solidifying the dollar's reserve currency status. What we're, you know, to put it differently, what we're really seeing is they're decoupling the reserve currency status from the petrodollar idea, and they're re-engineering the basis of that reserve currency status. At least that's the way I see it. You may see it somewhat differently, but given all the geopolitics that we've talked about, hidden system of finance, that's what I think is going on.
Well, here's the mistake. You know, the mistake we made in the 90s was the wall comes down, and instead of stepping up and leading the Bretton Woods system and sort of assuming a global leadership, we decided instead to go play global sweepstakes. You know those old games on TV where they give people a grocery basket and you had 5 minutes and the guy who won was the guy who could put the most stuff in his basket?
Right.
You know, and so we went on sort of a global sweepstakes, just trying to buy as much, as cheaply as possible, as fast as possible. You know, and it was really... it was sort of a pig fest instead of leadership is what it looks like to me.
Right.
And that's left quite a bitter pill in the world's.
Yes.
You know, they have a very bad taste in their mouth. And of course now what we're, you know, we've had 2 decades of neocons and everybody's sick of it because among other things, it's not just that they're brutal. It's that they play one track and it's not a one track world. I worked with a bunch of them when I was in the Bush administration. You know, and I hate to say this, these guys oversimplified to a point where it took your breath away. You couldn't believe that anybody was that arrogant and stupid at the same time. And they would use violence not to get away with things. They would use violence to get away with a mess they'd made because they wanted to think in one track.
Yes. Yeah.
It was just mind-boggling, and they thought the way to re-engineer things was to destroy them and then to control.
Yeah, it's I'll tell you what it is. If I can be blunt, it's a Venetian model. And what disturbs me, in spite of all of the financial chicanery and Byzantine cunning of the scenarios that we've just been talking about. We have to remember that, as you say, we are earning a lot of bad karma around the world. We are alienating some very, very powerful European allies. We are alienating Japan. We've managed to alienate most of South America. So in other words, just like Venice prior to the War of the League of Cambrai, your listeners may not know what that is, but there was a period in European history right at the height of the Renaissance where the European nations, Spain, France, Holy Roman Empire, and so on, papal states, were so fed up with Venice doing very much the same types of things that we've been discussing. They just decided to put an end to it. They all ganged up on Venice. And the only reason that Venice escaped was they used all of the diplomatic tricks in their bag of tricks to split that coalition apart. But building up such ill will around the world, not only just in Russia, not only just in Europe, but everywhere, that we could find ourselves in a kind of war of the League of Cambrai moment where the financial chicanery is just not going to be stood for anymore, and it's going to come down to a hot war. And that's what, you know, I hate to put it that way, but that's also in the cards. That's also a possibility that we have to consider.
Well, that brings me down to what I think is the most important point, which is the real military question.
Yes.
Who has, you know, I was talking with Richard about the underground bases, and he described the whistleblower who, I guess, said to Richard Sauter, you know, we have weapons down there, and Sauter said nuclear weapons, and he said, oh, no, much more powerful than nuclear weapons.
Yes.
And, of course, didn't describe exactly what that meant. But, you know, we're clearly, you and I know the story of the Russian, you know, the Russian plane that flew over the Navy ship that jammed all their electronics. Yes. And a reminder by Mr. Putin of, you know, what the Russians could do. But I, to me, this, I can't explain, you know, my biggest concern for America and the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency is if you look at what they're trying to do, it requires incredible leadership. Yeah. And yet I don't think the American leadership can pull off what they're trying to do.
No.
And the only argument, right, they don't, you don't have the cohesive leadership that you need to pull this off.
Right.
And the talent that you need to pull this off. And I think it's, you know, the only thing I can explain is they've got incredible weaponry backing them up. And of course, it's what Leonard Cohen said, we're blinded by the beauty of our weapons, and they've turned stupid and sloppy, you know, because of the power of their weapons. And so, unfortunately, for some period of time, this comes down to the nature of the weaponry, and that's the hardest thing to, you know, to see and even intuit. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting that you put it that way, because another thing that we've seen develop in the last few weeks are more demonstrations of the type that you referred to with the USS Donald Cook incident with the Russian fighter jamming the systems on that particular frigate. We've seen more demonstrations of that nature very, very recently. China has disclosed the existence of their X-ray pulse weapon. So in other words, what you see China and Russia in particular doing is reminding the West that we have our own exotic toys too. And these are just the ones we're showing you.
You know? Right.
I think it's their message of don't be too blinded by your weapons, because you really don't know what we have up our sleeve. And rest assured they do. I mean, there's not a great power in the world that doesn't have their own version of the black budget.
Right.
And in Russia's case, we have to remember that a great deal of Soviet military expenditure was precisely on black budget items, and that has never, ever relented, even in the sad, you know, post-Soviet Yeltsin years, that expenditure has never, ever slacked off. So, you know, it's a little warning to the wise that they're letting us know that they have some exotic toys too, and they're prepared to use them if they have to. So I don't doubt what that whistleblower said, that, you know, they have weapons far more powerful than nuclear weapons, because that's one of the things that I tried to get across in the second presentation I did at the Secret Space Program Conference, was that they have created systems now where they have weaponized, quite literally, weaponized the entire planet. And in some cases, I think you could make a case that they have certain capabilities with respect to the sun as well. So
right.
There are far more deadly things than nuclear weapons. And let's look at one of the technologies in particular that people need to remember. And it's a technology that's very well known. It's you know, out of the closet, and has been out of the closet for about 20 years. And that's the fuel-air bomb, the thermobaric bomb. You can make these bombs extraordinarily large. Your listeners can go online and do a search, a Google search, for the father of all bombs, and look at the picture of this Russian bomb being detonated. And you would swear that this is a nuclear explosion. It's so big. But it's entirely a conventional explosive. And what this means is that you now have weaponry that are capable of strategic offensive use destruction, that are not nuclear, that do not have the fallout consequences, the nuclear winter consequences. You have weapons now that can basically, with enough numbers, do the same job as nuclear war without the consequences. So that should give everybody pause. And Russia has these bombs. China has them. Germany has them. France, certainly. So we're looking at a very, very delicate geopolitical situation, and we cannot afford to have a leadership that's blinded by the beauty of our weapons, because other
right.
countries have them too.
Well, 2013, we spent, and this is just the overt economy, $1.7 trillion on military
Good grief.
And weapons. Now, 1.7 trillion a year could pay off all this debt mighty rapidly.
Yep.
So, you know, my question is not, can we afford the debt? Can we afford to be as warlike as we have been? Because to me, there's, you know, the debt is what makes it possible for me to behave badly and you to shut up because I just solve your problem with money. So you pay everybody in America, you give everybody in America a check and they go away.
Yeah.
And the way we've kept the political balance between the overt and the covert and the 1% and everybody else is everybody just, we just agree to have another deficit and give everybody a check.
Yeah.
And so everybody goes home and the debt goes up. And it's a, you know, so it facilitates a non-accountable system. As I said before, you can have a war before the peasants figure out that they're going to have to pay for it.
Yep, exactly.
You know, you just finance it in the bond market. So. I don't know, you know, I would love to see us evolve to a planet where we organize things on equity, because when we're in an equity model, if we're financing Iraq with equity, then we don't want to drop in and destroy it because all the pension funds are going to scream because we're destroying their equity.
Right.
You know, so equity builds global alignments and gets you to the point where you're all trying to do, you know, you're all trying to build out the Silk Road. You're all trying to build high-speed trains because that's what makes your equity go up.
Yep.
And the United States is in the odd situation of being in the business of destroying equity globally to make sure they can control the flow.
Yep.
And if anything, shutting down the economy, I would say, you know, that it's economic warfare and warfare that's shutting down the economy.
Absolutely. I'm totally agreed. In fact, let's go a little bit further, Catherine. You've mentioned many, many times this idea of an equity-based system of finance. And when you really look at it, what you see developing in the BRICS bloc, and particularly in the case of Russia and China, and to a certain extent India, as far as I can tell from those statistics that you shared with that report, what it looks like you have now in the world are two very different systems of finance. You've got an attempt, it looks to me, on the part of the BRICS nations, primarily led by China, to build up infrastructure. And you have, therefore, a kind of equity-based system of finance. And you look at the West, you look at the Anglo-American financial system in the West, you have precisely this debt-based warfare empire system. So we're really seeing a kind of peculiar economic version of Samuel Huntington's idea of a clash of civilizations. But what this really is it's a clash of two very different philosophies of finance. And ultimately, as we all know, you cannot have a system of finance, you cannot have a sound economy that's being run solely as a military machine, because they ultimately, all throughout history, every single time that this has been tried, they collapse.
Well, but here's what's interesting. If you look at the Anglo-American Alliance, they built the equity markets. They're the ones who really built the equity markets, made them powerful, made them deep, and then they figured out how to combine them with illegal cash flows, and then they really went to town.
Yeah.
And then they layered on derivatives and off, you know, then we were really off to the races. But, you know, if you look at their success at building liquid equity markets, it's one of the greatest achievements of the Anglo-American Alliance. And,
oh, yes, absolutely.
And so what we're watching, though, is a use of debt by the Anglo-American Alliance that could destroy, you know, one of the most powerful tools, or their control and leadership, because right now they still, you know, the market share of the Anglo-American Alliance has dropped dramatically as they've built out and helped to build out the equity markets globally. But they still are the leaders. 2007 and 2008 almost cost them that leadership, but,
yep,
you know, they still have the leadership, but the reality is, ultimately, they're going to have to decide, are they the leader of that system? You know, here's the question. In the emerging markets, it's governmental entities that are buying equities. They've never been buyers individually. Americans have been buyers, and our pension funds, of course, big buyers. So America and the Anglo-American Alliance are really the people who have equitized their society in that way. Now we've let bonds take over. Now the question, here's my question, here's the big question, Joseph. Is the explosion in debt part of the reengineering out of sovereign governments into corporations? Or is this an explosion of a planet that's just being harvested while everybody gets to Mars?
I think that's the $64 trillion question.
Yeah.
But in all honesty, I have to go with the second one, that this is part of the going to Mars scenario. Because again, going back to what we said earlier, we're putting so much financial juice, quite literally, into the financial circuit, and it's just not coming out at the low end. So it's going somewhere.
Right.
And the only thing I can think of, again, going back to what I observed earlier, with quadrillions of derivatives out there, and then also at the same time, quadrillions of resources, you know, in the asteroid belt, on the moon, on potentially on Mars and so on. What it looks to me is they collateralize space, and now they're going to go out there and get it and balance the books. That's the only thing that really ultimately makes any sort of sense to me. I just don't see this as being a purely terrestrial system anymore, other than perhaps your idea that they've built an endowment fund. I do see things going into corporations, because we see that it's the private corporations that are in this mad scramble to get out there into space, take people to Mars, colonize Mars, mine the asteroids, and so on and so forth. This is all being driven by these private companies. And I can assure you that the idea of doing all of this with chemical rockets is absurd. So there's some, just the fact that they're talking about all of this so openly right now convinces me that they've got other technologies that they're aware of and eventually are going to go out there and bring online. Or they could, you know, they could do what they did with the space program back in the 60s. They can put on the public show with the rockets, but have the technologies that actually do the heavy lifting not observable out there in space. That's the only other thing I can think of. But I definitely think it's the second one, that this is space.
Well, one of the things Musk has made very clear is we need reusable rockets.
Yeah.
You can't afford, you can't, yeah. Rockets cannot be a one-time deal. Well, here's, my takeaway when I look at the debt is I don't know if the debt is unsustainable or not, because I don't understand what the bleep is really going on. And one of the things I know is that we have the economic wherewithal to create so much equity so quickly that it will blow this debt out of the water.
Yeah.
So the people who say that we can crash up the stock market and take it to $30,000, you know, so the S&P, instead of being at 2,000, is at 30,000. That could happen. That really could happen. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I'm saying as an economic possibility, it's feasible.
Sure.
And so I look at the current wealth on planet Earth, and it's 1% of either what exists or what could exist if we could get into alignment.
Yeah.
But you can't have the 1% be billionaires, or the 1% of the 1% be all billionaires. So Bill Gates can't run around being worth $72 billion, thank you to NASA or NSA, while, you know, everybody else gets their check and everything is non-disclosed and secret. You know, that is a highly unproductive, highly dysfunctional, very expensive system and very unproductive system. So to do that system, you've got to have mucho debt and keep piling on the debt, which is what, you know, you're doing. The Treasury sells the debt, the central bank buys it, and then everybody gets a food stamp and, you know, disability check, and life goes on.
Yeah.
It's just a merry-go-round.
You mentioned Bill Gates, and you know, Bill Gates is a heavy investor in cold fusion. And the question again is why? Why would you invest so heavily in a technology that a certain segment of the scientific community views as fraudulent? The reason you do so is because there's something to it, and he wants to
right.
have his control over it. And it's very interesting. I had a blog recently about Dr. Andrea Rossi and his ECAT cold fusion reactor. He apparently has now sold a unit to a commercial enterprise. He's not said who it is, but he has indicated very clearly that he has done so, that it is in commercial use. I think that's very interesting because he's playing the game very cagily. He isn't revealing anything, but he's trying to spread the technology very deliberately and very cautiously. So again, you know, we're looking at game-changing technologies. There's just no two ways about this. And if you couple this as an energy source to space exploration, again, we're on the cusp of big things. I personally think that DARPA prediction of 100 years for warp drive, I think they're being conservative.
Right.
I really do. I think things could change so drastically and dramatically in the next century. And it could be, like you say, that they're running up all this debt simply as a mechanism of control over those technologies so that they don't have to worry about proliferation problems, about weaponization in the hands of some evil people. That's just honestly the way I see things, Catherine.
Or it could just be, you know, a never-ending game until it collapses of keeping everybody quiet with financial methadone.
Sure, sure.
The thing that concerns me is I'll never forget when I stopped by your place when we were figuring out the 3.0 transition, and you and I looked at each other. We were connecting different dots of what I was seeing driving across the country, what you were seeing. And you looked at me and you said, oh, my God, they're getting ready to move back into themselves.
Yeah.
And we realized that with the explosion in robotics and these new technologies, that the Anglo-American Alliance was preparing, and along with the fracking, to be far more self-sufficient.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
The one thing that worries me is if you look at what the neocons are up to and then what's possible with the interest rate bear trap and the fact that the whole – system is really setting itself up so it can pull back. If they throw the interest rate bear trap and then pull back,
yeah,
it could be a very ugly little world for a while.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think if that scenario would be true, and I think there's a lot to argue for it, but if it be true, then the reason they're doing it is as a hole card, as a worst case scenario possibility.
Right.
That if they have to do that, then they've retrenched themselves adequately enough to protect their power base, which, like it or not, is still in North America. So I don't think that that's necessarily what they're going to do, but they have that as an option if they need to.
Right. And that's why I tell everybody this year you want to keep a very close eye on the U.S. dollar index, and you want to keep a very close eye on the interest rates as you watch the geopolitics of what's playing out in Europe, because those will be very important indicators of what's happening.
Yep.
So my bottom line is the debt may or may not be unsustainable. What we need to do is understand is why is this happening? And where is the leadership really going? And I'm with you. I think the it's the black budget or the hidden. We need to come up with a name. It's the breakaway finance that's driving the train.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
And it's driving the financial system now. And, you know, it's got the bit in its teeth. And we don't know where it's going or what it's up to quite yet. Yes. We figured out a lot. And you can't look at this debt without looking at it through that prism of the geopolitics of what's really happening. It's a control system.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
All I know is you probably don't want to move to Japan.
No. No. It's not on my list.
Well, one of the things you hear when you talk with people who live in different countries is the more, generally, the higher the debt, the more repressive the culture.
Yes.
And, you know, the more debt you have, the less risk everybody can afford, the more centralized things are. And I'm always struck with people around the world who are in areas of the world that have less debt or just less financial system. You know, they talk about how much more free it is and how much happier it is.
Yes, and it's interesting that you mentioned the correlation between debt and repression, because there was, I believe just this last week, the Japanese announced that they were going to revivify their intelligence service, which officially they have not had since the end of World War II. Now, I don't believe for a moment that Japan doesn't have an intelligence service. But what I think that announcement really means is we're going to beef it up tremendously. And that means both in terms of their international espionage capability, but I also strongly suspect in terms of their domestic and counterintelligence capabilities within Japan itself. So, yeah, I think there's a definite correlation.
Before we close, I just have to bring up once again that article that Richard Haass wrote in the November Foreign Affairs called The Unraveling. Mm-hmm. And it was our interpretation that it was the more moderate members of the leadership saying to the neocons, you know, you need to just calm down and behave. You need to cool it. Yep. Because it's not just, you know, everybody around the world who's had it. It's also the American leadership has had it with the neocon element. There must be aliens and they must be supporting the neocons, because I cannot see where their power is. As far as I can see, everyone far and wide is fed up with them.
Yeah.
So why are they still there?
My speculation, again, goes back to the thing that I've been trying to document in several books, and that is the very powerful and pervasive influence of whatever this international fascist organization is. Because
right. There's
no doubt, if you look at American
right. Culture
and society now, it's turning horribly fascist and repressive. I think a large part of it is due to some sort of hidden influence of that sort. I really do.
It's one of the most amazing things of 2014 was reading intellectual garbage after intellectual garbage explaining the source of inequality. And I'm very clear, violence is the source of inequality.
Yes. Yes.
You know, when you have a group of people who can kill with impunity above and are completely above the law,
yep.
You know, they will control.
Yep.
And that's where it comes from. And if you watch all the different explanations and rationales of what's happening with technology and the financial system and merit and competition and, you know, all these different things, it all continuously comes back to violence and the control that violence, enforces, which always brings us back to the black budget.
Yep.
So, which is why I think disclosure is so important if we're ever going to figure this out, and which is why I'm so grateful for your help in having this conversation. It's the first time I've ever talked about the debt system on this planet when I could talk with somebody else and talk about it as an integrated whole. So this was very energizing. Okay, so tell us what's next for Dr. Joseph Farrell. You've got one or two books coming. I'm dying for another one.
It's been very difficult the last few months for me to write. It seems like every time I sit down to do so, something pops loose that I've got to take care of. But I do have a contract for a book that will hopefully be coming out in August. I've got to write it. it's going to be, let's just say it's going to be about the European situation and its relationship
Ooh, good.
To to communism, to Nazism, fascism. It's going to be kind of a continuation, as it were, of where I let things off with the Nazi International. I'm going to try and bring it up to, more or less, bring it up to the present. There's a lot out there that I have not yet covered.
Yeah,
that I think now's the time to cover it and expose some of these things that people may not even be aware of.
I used to have a partner on the trading floor, Dylan Reed, who, when the market was up, he would scream out, "The ducks are squawking, I must feed them." And that's one of the questions I get. This is a Larry Report. When's Farrell's next book going to become available?
Well, it should be soon. I get settled and everything. I'm planning to hit the pavement hard with the wheels already spinning and burning rubber. The book is written in my head. I've just got to sit down and force myself to type it.
Okay, and of course everybody can come. How often are you doing your vid chats?
I do a vid chat about once every 2 weeks. The schedule is posted in the members area on the calendar. They're about once every 2 weeks.
Okay, and it's GizaDeathStar.com.
GizaDeathStar.com, right.
Okay, and all the books are there, and you can link to the secret space program speeches that you gave.
Right.
Which I strongly, strongly recommend.
Well, they're all up on YouTube. All the presentations from Mark McCandlish on Saturday morning to Dr. Rosen on Sunday evening, they're all up there now.
Right, I assure you, if you watch them, you will never look at the financial system the same way again.
Yes, I guarantee you that. If people want to get the financial thing, they need to watch your presentation that you did on Sunday morning, and then watch the presentation I did on Saturday.
I have them watch your Saturday first, and then mine, and then the one you did on Sunday.
Well, they can watch them in pretty much any order, but that's probably the logical order to watch them in.
Okay. Okay, well, Joseph, if anybody can help us figure it out, it's you. So,
well, thank you.
Keep going.
Same to you. Because I wouldn't have ever considered any of these financial questions in quite the depth that you consider. So,
well, I think I want to keep going. So we've talked about planet debt, but we do need to bring it down to a household and community level. And figure out how we help protect. That's my passion. I want to help protect. I want families and people to be able to navigate this and not get, confused, tricked, whatever. We all need to use our time and our resources wisely. And so that's where the rubber meets the road. How can I make sure that our, whether it's my subscribers or your members, know what they need to know to be wise in their allocation of time and resources.
Yep. Here.
Okay. Okay. Have a great evening, Joseph. Thank you again.
Yep. Thanks for having me back on, Catherine.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you again for joining us, Planet Debt with Dr. Joseph Farrell. Have a wonderful evening, too.